Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 24th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, we will have a continuing series of theme forums. Tonight's session is number 5 and is entitled, Where is the Spirit Leading Us in Worship? Let's listen in.
Even though it's somewhat quickly after Vespers, we'll start and people will wander in as they get to the end of the ice cream line and so get their sandwiches made for tomorrow in the ever eternally springing hope that tomorrow will be a hiking day. Welcome, my name is Deanne Lagerquist. I'm one of the program coordinators this summer, and I'm glad to see a few people who are interested not only in participating in worship but also talking about worship. This is a form that springs out of this summer's theme, water washed and spirit born. We move maybe to away from the water washed into the spirit born tonight in a way that we haven't so much already this summer, to ask about one of the things that we do together as the body of Christ, namely to worship. We have, as usual at a Holden Forum, 3 people to get us started. But really the goal of a forum here is for the saints to consult together, to share wisdom, to share questions, to share insights, and that we will all come away enriched in our understanding of what sometimes are difficult issues. Now, I admit last week when it was on sex and marriage, I retreated to my chalet to greet my husband, who I hadn't seen for 3.5 weeks, and left that one for somebody else to moderate. But tonight I'm willing to take on worship, which is something perhaps that we feel more free to express our opinions about. We ask in a form that you would be respectful of one another, and open to learning from them, not necessarily that you agree with everything everyone else says. There's a lovely little passage from a 19th century German Lutheran pastor about worship that I'm very fond of, and I have to admit that, like Paul, who seems to have known the Greek philosophers from anthologies, I know this because I heard someone read it in a devotion and then I asked her to send me a photocopy of that page. So I can't tell you much about the whole essay, but Wilhelm Lohe says about, in an essay about worship, just as the stars revolve around the sun, so does the congregation in its services, full of loveliness and dignity, revolve around the Lord. In holy childlike innocence, which only a child's innocent heart understands properly, the multitude of redeemed, sanctified children of God dances in worship around the universal Father and the Lamb, and the Spirit of the Lord God guides their steps. And it's really that question about how the Spirit of the Lord God guides our steps in worship that we want to address tonight. We have 3 people to get us started. I think of these people as the primers of the pump, the ones to get the water of conversation flowing. And tonight they represent not only themselves, but I don't seem to speak for everyone in their class, but they represent 3 classes of people: a musician, a pastor, and a lay participant in worship. And they are Mary Price and David Aker and Libby Christian. And I'm going to let each of them introduce themselves further insofar as it seems pertinent to them. And then they'll each address very briefly these questions. What is worship that works? So what's the criteria of what makes good worship, which might take us into the question, what is worship for? And then what makes it work and what makes it not work? And we'll just go like you are sitting, starting with Mary, who has just been working at leading us
at
in worship.
Worship. My name is Mary Preuss, and I think really my best credentials come from the fact that I've probably spent most of my life in worship. My father is a Lutheran pastor, and many of my relatives are pastors or workers in the church, and my mother at a certain point when I was growing up was also the church organist, so she had to take all three of us kids and we'd stay there as long as they had to be there. So that might have meant sitting through a few services, and during the high holy days it might have been a long day at least on a Sunday or whatever. So worship for me, and as a kinesthetic type learner, is something that's in some ways hard for me to describe in words, because it's something that I feel I experience, and my judge of whether it's good or bad often is just whether or not I feel I really experienced worship or was somehow had some barriers to that. So what makes worship work for me then would be if what Deanne described in her opening quote, like a child, I feel led and drawn into the holy dance or the drama of worship, where we as Christians come together to renew our baptism and our beliefs, to come together at table to eat, to hear the word, and to be sent on our way, would be the main criterion for me then. Do I feel that that drama was played out, I was drawn into it, and then sent out on my way renewed and ready to go back and do that work again? Keep doing that work. So, and then I would have to say, in just thinking about in a simple and short way, what I think are two for me of the primary barriers to that happening would be, one, that the life of the particular community, that church congregation, is not fully expressed in worship. And what I mean by that is, for example, if you're doing a service that you've just been doing for 85 years without considering how that particular body of Christ meeting right there might be reflected in that worship service. And that to me happens in a very small diversity right within the congregation. Are there old people and young people? Are there people from the neighborhood and people from far away? And then are all those people part of considering how worship goes? So to me, when it fails often is if the worship somehow doesn't seem to reflect the life of that particular community. And then the second way is if it's not well prepared. And that to me is just about, it's difficult to feel drawn in and able to enter into that holy drama if the pastor runs in at the last minute, the choir sings really poorly, whatever, you know, all the things that you've experienced. If someone forgot to, turn the lights on so nobody can read their books, there's all, as you well know, most of any of you have been part of preparing worship, there are a billion details. And although it does often seem like the production of a play, it is not a performance, and that would be something else we could talk about. So that's mine.
Thanks. I'm Dave Aker, and as of last week, I've been a Lutheran pastor for 23 years. It's been fun this week to have people that I've shared in worship with from Brooklyn, New York, and from Crookston, Minnesota, and as well as the congregation people that I serve in Fargo. I'm in Fargo, North Dakota. What makes worship work, I think, is the word connection, or, you know, to pull off that koinonia, that community, and some of the same things that you've said, Mary. The pastor that started the service tonight, I forgot her name.
Susan.
She drew us in. And for me, that's, if that doesn't happen, for me, worship doesn't happen. I can have the finest crafted sermon, but if I don't make a connection at the beginning of the service, the sermon is just a bunch of words. And so there has to be some connection. I operate with two kind of fundamental ideas. One is that most of us don't come to church ready to worship. That we need some dialogue, some conversation. Sometimes that happens out in the narthex before we come in. When I'm kind of free of some of the other things and can be there and welcome people, worship always is different. Rather than at the end of the service when I greet the folks as they go. If I do that before, there's more of a connection. I'm connected with them, and then it's our sermon, it's not my sermon. The greatest compliment when worship for me works, the greatest compliment is when people come out of worship and say, thank you for the worship, or thank you for the service. Some people will say, thank you for the sermon. That's not always a compliment for me. Because the music, the sermon, it's all together. And so it's not a performance. It's not the organ performance, or it's not the choir performance, or the past, my sermon performance. But it's the service, the whole worship. A second piece that I kind of operate with is that I'm not always ready to confess my sin at the beginning of the worship. I find that I'm more ready to confess my sin at the end of the service and have, quote, interrupted the pattern. And a few times have had the confession of sin and absolution at the end of the service rather than the beginning. It is when the lights get turned on in worship, the light gets turned on, that I see my sin. And it's not just because I invite people to confess their sin. They don't see it, I don't see it at the beginning. And so so that, first of all, that idea of connection, that I don't come ready to worship, that there has to be some kind of drawing in. And sometimes I do that with announcements as a way of connecting the community and having a little dialogue with them, and then beginning or really continuing the worship then.
Good, thanks, Tim. I'm Libby Christian, or Elizabeth Christian in some circles. I live in Port Angeles, Washington now, as of the last 5 years, originally from White Bear Lake, Minnesota. And I grew up in the Episcopal Church, and in my adult life I've characterized that worship experience as definitely low church. But I do hold the Book of Common Prayer deep within me. I think it's cellular. And started hanging out with Lutherans when I went off to one of the Lutheran colleges at age 18, and I've been a Ludapisk ever since. And I don't, I'm not sure why I'm here, I guess as lay person, but I do know that I think about worship, and it's a pretty passionate and probably ill-formed thing inside of me. But I feel like I'm a little primed, thanks to Mary and Tom's session this morning, because it sure raised a lot of questions about what's worship and what is it and why do we do it, and what works and what doesn't. A couple things that are playing off really what you both said. Having told you my sketch biography, you would say I come from a liturgical tradition, and I only know two words in Greek, having never gone to seminary, but one of them, my understanding is that the roots of liturgy is the work of the people. And if that's true, then I really come from an aliturgic tradition, because my experience in church has largely been sort of sliding into a comfortable, rote thing that doesn't take any preparation, that's comfortable and certainly beautiful and worthy, but it is not any kind of work. And both of you are talking about the importance of preparedness. One of the things we're experiencing in Port Angeles now is we're really trying to open our doors to the community and be welcoming to families who have maybe never been to church or are not currently going to church. And one of the responses has been to have what's called a contemporary service. One of the things that I do like about that, I think it, in the root word, is more liturgical, is that at the beginning, prayer requests are taken and discussed. And the whole congregation can kind of raise up, we'll pray for my Aunt Ruth, she's having knee surgery next week, think about my brother Tom who's traveling, blah, blah, blah. And then a full 20 minutes or 30 minutes later, one person who's been pre-designated leads the congregation in prayer. And that has been a work. And we're drawn together because, I don't know Aunt Ruth or Cousin Tom, but I've at least had a few minutes to reflect on their current situation and their need. So that has worked well for me. The rest of the service doesn't, frankly, but but that has gotten me thinking about how do we come in. And I agree, Susan's drawing us in, talking about our body hurting. That's pretty graphic, and I can get that. I think a lot of women in the audience could get that. We've been good at that for a long time, hurting for others. That really drew me into this experience, which seems so far away. In terms of the black churches being burned. So okay. Being prepared in some common experience.
Good. Some common themes already emerging. The one about being prepared, that worship is work. Whether or not you come from an anthropological perspective that says the human is by nature a religious being inclined to worship, what we're hearing from these people is the inclination needs a little direction. And particularly if we do it together. Once heard a campus pastor, an Episcopal campus pastor say, this is the most unnatural activity in the world, to expect a room full of people to all do and think the same thing simultaneously about something we don't yet know. This is very strange. So preparedness, connection, both within the body taking part and beyond the community, and also something about change I'm hearing, that in the course of the activity, good worship changes us. So, responses.
I just want to add one thing after hearing Dave say, when you said the question out loud, what makes worship work, the first thing that just leaped to my mind after I'd already said my whole thing is, if liturgy is the work of the people, then it's powered by the Holy Spirit. So,
Good.
That definitely has been made known to me often in worship.
When I would just add one other thing, too,
can't stop us now.
No.
So just be preparing your responses, because clearly you've got to jump in.
Really fast.
Okay.
I asked my church council to be an active leader in prayer for our congregation, and what they do every Sunday morning is they meet me in the sacristy and pray for me. And they, during the week, either pick up or are sent the lessons that are going to be in the worship. And some of them write the prayer, some of them just wing it. They pray for me, and they pray for the worship as we come into worship. And it's made a... The congregation at this point doesn't know that the church council people are doing that, but it's been really a wonderful experience, and I think it is making a difference in what happens in the sanctuary.
I have a comment. I don't go to a Lutheran church now, but I have it one time, and I tried to get them to start using the Green Book instead of the one that was written in the 20s or 30s, and they did switch, but it didn't sound like worship to them anymore. It was the same meeting, but the tune was different, and they've done it for so many years that that is what sounded like worship to them, and so they didn't even feel like they were worshiping. What do you have to say about that?
I have had the same conversation 100 times with my father about the 1926 or 1928 Book of Common Prayer in the Episcopal Church. And he, I mean, at age 86, that stuff, you know, he will be able to, I don't think he will, lose his mind and still know that. You know, it's so deep. Mm-hmm. So that experience is so deep for him. And I kind of envy that, having that. Ooh. But good gravy, you know, 86 years in the life of the church is just a moment. Mm-hmm. And we got to remember that, you know, Queen Victoria did a little differently, and whoever, King Henry VIII did a little differently. And then there was Martin, you know, it's been changing all the time. We got to get a handle on that, and it will continue to change.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly one of the other issues that we could talk about, that mm-hmm. the balance between the familiar mm-hmm. and the innovative, and where novelty fits. In that, I mean, as you described that about your father at age 86, I think of the brother-in-law of a good friend of mine who died of brain cancer not long ago, and one of the last, well, he'd been incoherent for weeks, and then someone came and sang Haugen Vespers with him, and he sang it, mm-hmm. you know, with the right words and on tune. Mm-hmm. So there's something about how this common activity gives voice to deep longings as well.
One thing that our congregation does is I find that's really helpful in this line of familiar service and visitors coming in. We have a bulletin that we call Visitor Friendly. And basically our whole service is done in the bulletin. It's a lot of extra work for our church secretary. But anybody can walk in, pick up the bulletin, and not have to look here, and all this other. It's all laid out right there for them. And we can take that and introduce a different type of service to the congregation, and they not stumble through it either. That they're able to just pick it up and just go with it. And it really makes it flow. And you feel good about it.
He touched upon the thing that I find so distracting in our church as just a member. Is that so many times we are singing from a contemporary book, the old green hymnal, you're following a service out of this, you're switching things all the time, and you don't, you know, you're lost.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to really
the
get the message of the
papers are dropping out.
See, where am I out? Well, then you grab this one, then you put that one down and grab the next one. Just, you know, and it's so confusing, even for us who've been members for years. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes, why do they plan services like that? I guess I need to get on the worship committee.
Yeah. Well, the number of worship resources that are available now is getting to be just quite overwhelming. And as, in some ways, as we become more ecumenical within our worship, we are accepting. There are still plenty of churches that will only go with whatever's prescribed by their denomination. But many places are accepting a lot of other resources. And it adds and expands to the richness of our worship. But we have certainly found, Tom and I talked about this in our workshop this morning, that it's very difficult to have a big pile of worship resources for people. And what we see a lot of churches moving toward, but of course everyone doesn't have these resources either, are what you just mentioned, and that is publishing your own worship resource every week on your bulletin, which may include things from all kinds of different places. But you're getting the copyright permissions and doing everything that's necessary in order to have a... Now, in some ways, I think that's nasty, too, to have 12 pages to read through or whatever, and bad for the trees in our world, but hopefully we can figure it out.
We recycle.
Yeah. Recycle paper, that's what it goes.
Our church was pretty well, I mean, it was harder than even go from the red hymnal to the green hymnal. And the way we taught them how to do that was that we did it in Bible school, taught the children the whole service with the guitar and then with the organ, and then they taught their families on that Friday night. So that's how we got into the green hymnal many years ago. To get into other things now, our pastor, to get in our With One Voice, he kept slipping songs in our bulletin for one song during the service out of that book. So when that book came into our pew, if, for those that say, oh no, another hymnal, he said, well, you've been singing songs out of this one already, you know, and so, and we already do Marty Haugen anyway, so that, then the other thing is we have the Catholics that meet in our church at 5 o'clock at night, and they have their Bread for Life that changes every November. With Advent, they get a brand new book, and we use songs from theirs, and they use songs from ours. So on that, just because it's there, we're learning new songs, and they're learning new songs. But it's, I think it just takes practice.
What I've started to hear from these comments is a predisposition for newness equals good worship. Is that really what you want to say?
No. I think what we mentioned earlier is a really key conversation. What you, how the way you put it, Deanne, was holding in the balance the need for familiarity in worship. The thing that really struck me was in college, part of my work for an ethnomusicology class was to go to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church for a whole semester of college and worship with them. And they were doing liturgy that had been done for 1,500 years. And that is what they said was the point of it,
yeah,
in many ways, was the fact that it was, and the way it was described to me by their music director was just poetically beautiful. He said, these sounds have been moving through time in the lives of our people for 1,500 years, and we need them. They're part of our very existence. And I thought to myself, that was when it first struck me, like, don't I need what a friend we have in Jesus that I learned as a child in church? Or, you know, the very first thing in my baby book my mom wrote was that Mary knows all the words to Holy, 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 because we sang that in our church every Sunday. That was about when I was just talking, you know. So is that important to keep? I mean, I think that's a very important question for us to ask as we expand our worship.
You look like you're just about ready to want to say something. That leaning up, no? My students learn not to move a muscle.
I'm keen on the word preparation and do it good. And I agree with you on change. Change is not necessarily good nor bad. I'm not a lifelong Lutheran, although I started being a Lutheran basically a couple years before I went to PLU. And the tradition of the green hymnal is the only one I've known. Well, I know the red and green, but I need that. I like that tradition that I've gotten from the liturgies. And the liturgy, you talk about your 86-year-old father-in-law.
Father.
You know, I'm not 86 yet, but I still watch that liturgy envelop me. And I almost, when I walk into church, and if I'm in the cantor, then it's a little different. But if I'm in the pew, then I can let the liturgy just enfold me. And I can just be part of it. And that's worshipful for me. That's the basis for my worship. If I go to a contemporary worship, which we have at our church also, nothing enfolds me. It just kind of goes.
Okay.
So I need that tradition.
Do you only use one setting then?
At a time. For service. No.
But Bill, you're giving us another interesting set of things, because on the one hand you say preparation. And on the other being enfolded, which seems sort of pre-rational.
Well, but the good service to me will do that. The well done, the good service. Do we have one service? Well, right now we do because of what's going on in our church, and that's a different story. But we've used several, all of the liturgical services in our book, plus we use Marty Haugen, plus we use others, and I can let them all unfold me if they're done.
Right.
I see.
Right.
So you're talking more with the contemporary service that it's not done well, when it bounces off.
Well, maybe it's done well according to contemporary positions. Well, it's not liturgical in any way, shape, or form.
Ah. Well, that's another matter,
because
you can do an alternative service to the LBW and still have a liturgical form.
Yes, but there is no liturgical form in their contemporary service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, it's
and is
not.
That
you're not in a Lutheran church in our contemporary service.
Is that form? Does that form have something to do with this notion of change and connection? That we are changed through the service? Well, when you say it has no form, is that means that it's the same all the way through. Consequently, it doesn't change you. It's just one thing.
You're not led through a process.
Yeah, there's no process in it.
I was just thinking that for a while, and I don't know where they got it from, but when we would do the ordinary or the beginning of the confession of sins, and you get to the congregational response, and I was just thinking, for as much as I say I know it, you know, right offhand, I can't say it. But I loved it at a few times when they've taken in, I wanted to say his name is Henry Schreiner, but I don't know who it is, but who they used for their input as to our worship preparation. But he's taken a few lines, kind of going along with the theme of the Sunday, and have put it into that congregational response to the confession. Mm. And all of a sudden, I have to read it. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, oh, I can't just say it. And see, I like the fact that somebody's jerked me out of my complacency of saying, I'm here to worship now, I'll go through it all. I love it when I'm jerked out and say, oh, you have to read this. Oh, this sounds pretty good.
Oh, that would annoy me so much.
And I just heard someone in a village say this too. We need to wake up during the liturgy. She said, I want to wake up. I don't want to just be lulled into something. I want to wake up.
I'm already awake.
I think people think it's meditative to have that lulling too.
Well, see, I think this is something we have to hold in the balance, because for some people, you, like you're saying, Anne, you're awake. You're awake and you're being drawn into something that's... What is it that's good for you about
having
it be the same?
Well, this confession that we're as you're talking about, I love to do that from memory, even though I know it looks snippy not to have my book open. But it's a prayer. To me, it's just prayerful, so I'm like having it memorized, and even though I just made the transition from the red book memorization to the green book memorization. And that could just be that I'm a language person, and I like to have those words just kind of flow through me, and it's not, I'm not sleepy at all, I'm totally into it. But if I had to be opening up my bulletin and figuring out, you know, what's new this week, I wouldn't get the same prayerfulness out of it. I'd get something else, right? But right. It wouldn't be... Yeah.
Well, Marion, is your point still... Are we still on your point?
Still on my point?
Yeah, I mean, you had your hand up a while ago.
I guess I wanted to, since this was mentioned about... I wanted to plug into... I think all of us come into worship with our biases.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very critical of the music. If the choir director doesn't do a good job, or the choir is flat, the sopranos are not with it, it just upsets me so much that it just throws me right out of kilter. If the banners are not well done, and not that they don't fit the season, but they're not well executed, I come in with my biases. I'm a music and an art teacher, and I'm very critical. And somehow, I fight this, saying, well, none of this makes any difference. You know, what is the difference if the sopranos are flat, or the banners are, you know, not, that really isn't this, the design is terrible, to be able to look like this or this. And what is the difference? Well, I guess the difference is that it affects me. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time with that. I really do, and sometimes I can't climb over that. Mm-hmm. So I think all of us come in with our biases, mm-hmm. and what we're looking for, what right. turns us on.
So some of the barriers are what we bring with us, and some of the barriers
right.
are what we find.
Yeah, and this baggage is, you can't leave it at the door. Even if the pastor shakes my hand, I still cannot drop it if you come in with me, because it's a part of me.
One thing I'm hearing is everybody has to belong to the right family. Mm-hmm. Family you're comfortable with. The congregation you're comfortable with. We come from a small enough area where there's 3 Lutheran churches in our town.
Well, I love it. Small enough to have 3 Lutheran churches.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're large enough that. Whichever point of view.
You don't have to be very big for that.
Point of reference. But anyway, our congregation states that we're the other Lutheran church. If they want high church, they can go to the other 2. We're the ones that's going to try something different. And we're known through the town as having that reputation. And so if you're going to our church, the one we belong to, that you will expect something different. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do a lot of public ministry and stuff like that.
Carol?
I was just trying to get a handle on, is there something here that that is about style that we sometimes confuse with content? One of the things that, I'm a pastor, and one of the things that I would love to have is my congregation appreciate all the different styles of liturgy. I mean, I have to do a 16th century mass, high church one Sunday, and the next Sunday have an African service, or, you know, that would be my ideal, but I can't do that the same way. You have to get some good musicians, and I don't have the church that has that kind of music department. But I've done quite a number of different styles of worship, and I think that the key for my congregation to appreciate them is to have preparation for them, not just for the choir or for the pastor or the musician, the preparation for them, which means you have to say something once in a while about what, reminding them what worship is and how their own attentiveness to what is being done is in there. And I'm always surprised that whenever I talk about those things, that they like it. I mean, like, think, well, they know this, but they need to be reminded so that there is a sense in which it's okay to struggle with something new, because we're all trying to do something we're not used to, and if you repeat it enough, then they've got that down, and they can come back to it and appreciate it. But I it's really hard for me. I like change, and I didn't realize how different I was because I like change. But it really is hard for some people to change. And style has a lot to do with.
I vision being part of a mission congregation, one kind or another, depending on, we seem to keep moving into areas where the local Lutheran church is a mission congregation, which means you've got an awful lot of people who aren't raised
Lutheran,
which means that you do a certain amount of accommodating, and there are days when I say to myself, look, if they don't like our hymns, why are they in our church? Why can't they learn Built on a Rock? But, on the other hand, they contribute a lot of richness. And you're right, you know. You begin to learn about them, and you begin to learn about their traditions, and you begin to incorporate them into yours. It's fun. Mm-hmm. However, I'm throwing out a challenge. You know, you're all talking about different services, and let's do this, and let's do that, and let's do that. What's wrong with going back to the Norwegian Lutheran Church hymn book of 1945, 46, 47, and doing that service once in a while? It's a beautiful service.
I think that's a wonderful idea, but the key is to explain why, that you're not doing it just because you want to be cozy, but there's some value. And I think of that with bringing in people who've never been to a liturgical service, or with the kids in our congregation who are saying, well, why are we doing this? And there's a certain amount of dissension in our congregation and a little bit of division. Who goes to 8:30 to the liturgical service, and who goes to the 11, the non-liturgical service? But nobody's talking about the value of what each one of them is doing. You're supposed to sort of get it by osmosis. And that doesn't help the kids any. They dabble in this one, and they dabble in this one. And my fear is a lot of them go to the 11 o'clock service because it's easy. There's only about 3 notes in each song.
And you don't have to get up so early.
And you don't have to get up so early. That's probably key. You can't hear it. But nobody, none of us who espouse this wonderful liturgy are saying anything about where did that form come from? Mm-hmm. What do those mm-hmm. words mean? Look at this hymn. Yeah, it's got six stanzas, but this is a nugget of our theology. We're not doing that, and I think we got to do a whole lot better job at saleswomanship.
Education.
Thank you.
Education is the word.
Yeah. This is an interesting connection to last week's theme for when we talked about fostering faith. After baptism, what next? How do we foster faith? Well, now what we hear is that fostering faith is also about fostering this community activity. Doesn't just come by participating, even for someone like Mary, who clearly participated and has, you say, well, it's hard for me to talk about, but you talk about it very well.
Well, you know, what I realized growing up in the church so often is that I didn't learn what you said, Libby, why. And finally, when I went to church with a couple of pastors who do this so beautifully and naturally as a part of worship, John Schramm is one person at the community of St. Martin when I was there who would say, and now we take the uncommon, we take the common for an uncommon purpose, which was the beginning of the Eucharist. We're taking our bread that we eat every day for an uncommon, and I was like, oh, wow, you know, this was a new idea. This is such a transforming idea for me. Joel Oinas did that at his church when Tom and I were there playing. As parts of the liturgy would come along, he'd just have maybe one sentence that beautifully said why we're now moving into this part of the drama. And I thought, now, could the seminary teach that to pastors? Or, well, how can pastors come out of the seminary not knowing why we're doing the liturgy? And then please keep continuing to say that to the congregation. Very helpful.
And not just pastors, but mothers.
Yes, right.
Godmothers, yeah.
Fathers, maybe even. David is a pastor of our church, and when he came there, he did a little thing that's quite different. The baptismal font always sat to the left, and he kind of moved it right to the center where the ushers would have to split. The bride and groom might have to stand on each side of it or something. And he put it in the way, and all of a sudden, baptism was kind of right there. And
kind of became the way.
Wow.
Yeah. It became the way, and then we've David brought a little song for communion that made the communion a lot more special for all of us. And it, just a little bit of, couple little things put some religion back in our church that's 105 years old. Okay. We're a good coffee church. Yeah. Now we're a lot better religious church.
I don't know many churches that have good coffee.
Next time I'm in near Fargo, I'm coming to check it out.
Yeah.
I know Seattle is pretty good with their
weed. Yeah, that's not what you're there for.
Yeah, but we did. Right. We tried doing Starbucks coffee, and our older members said it was too strong.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to distract us. I'm sorry. We don't need to talk about the coffee hour.
The coffee here is getting better.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
Yes, Chris.
I was interested, Mary, that you said worship isn't performance. And I want to make a couple of comments about that and then at least have you respond, because I think that's an interesting question. Part of the reason I think looking at worship as performance can be helpful is because there's a way of looking at someone doing a ritual that's very unusual or very different than me that allows me to understand what goes on in doing that for them. And it helps me then to see that strange thing as making sense, and it helps me then to look at my own things that are familiar as being a little bit strange. So when I put things that are unusual to me and things that I do on the same plane and say these are both performances, how are they different, how are they the same, then it helps me to get a little bit of distance between my preferences and what other people might like to do, and it helps me to be more open to some of the other things that are done or that people want to have done during worship. And I find that really helpful in bridging some of the divisions that happen in the debates about what we should do in church, contemporary, traditional, things like that.
I think, well, that the way you're describing it, Chris, to me sounds more like what Deanne said earlier, and that is that the liturgy in some ways is an unusual thing for people to be doing. So you're saying to yourself, well, it's like a performance, and that's how you can kind of interpret. And what I mean when I say it shouldn't be a performance is that the people sit in the pews and watch something happen like TV. That's the thing I think that's so easy to happen in our culture now, that everybody's just watching videos and stuff, is to, we go to a lot of congregations like that where, boy, you're working up there to get the participation going amongst people instead of just having them be able to, you know, not even sing a thing, not even follow along in what's going on.
One of the things I liked in terms of performance that you were talking about is if pastors talked more about what liturgy participation or performance is about. Like, for instance, I would say that the congregation is in a performance when they're sitting, listening to a reading of a lesson or listening to a sermon being preached, because they're a part of that drama that's going on. And you shape your participation. You can sit attentively, leaning forward, or you can kind of lean back, like, well, prove to me how something worth saying. Or you can, you know, show the person that you're being thoughtfully engaged by putting your hand. You know, there's all sorts of body language things that we do to participate or not in what's going on, just when we're sitting there.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, it's funny because you use the word drama and performance interchangeably, and for some reason I feel better about drama, using the word drama for the liturgy, that we're all in a drama together. Performance to me still has that thing that makes it seem like a concert or something.
It's performing for someone.
Yeah. Yes.
You study too much with Michael Ani. That's the problem here.
He's doing ritual theory.
Have you noticed how simpler,
which I don't mean to undermine, but
have you noticed how much simpler anthems are, church anthems, choir anthems, and solos? You aren't getting the elaborate art songs anymore. Those are performances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think they kind of pass through in some ways, and people found them too difficult, right, to either do or hear. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of churches, in small, you know, small churches or whatever.
I think one of the interesting things is to ask congregational groups what they think, what does worship look like? I mean, I'm not talking about style, but for instance, lots of parishioners, I was appalled at this, but lots of my parishioners and lots of people that I know watch TV evangelists, you know, on occasion. And so if they have an idea that worship is different from, say, having a religious meeting in which somebody's up there explicating biblical passages, with one of those wraparound Bibles that they always use, you know. So, but you've got to have a leather Bible that wraps around your hand. But I think that if you ask what worship is like, what does it mean to worship? They get it right away that it's not just sitting there watching somebody else do the work, that they're offering something, praise to God, for instance, and for starters. And I think just to raise that question and to get that kind of conversation going with parts of your congregation is an important step towards helping them appreciate worship in a lot of different varieties.
Well, growing up in a Lutheran church, I always thought that it was the pastor that was supposed to pray, and so we never learned how to pray. And you'd get together in a group situation with people from other congregations, and they were great at contributing to the prayer session, but we Lutherans didn't know how to say a prayer.
How to pray or dance.
No pastor was ever. We just sat there and listened. And I like it now in our congregation when, not only with prayer, but when the gospel is read, that the congregation often joins the pastor in reading the gospel. I think that involves us more than just listening to him read it.
So another theme that emerges here is the issue about participation, that worship is a participatory rather than a spectator activity. Then what counts as participation becomes important. So can you participate from the pew? Is that legitimate participation for you? Do you have to be the leader? I have to say, as a lay member of a congregation, on the Sundays when I get asked to lead something, my experience is totally different, you know? Because then I'm trying to remember, do I have the right page, and where am I supposed to be, and I'm going to pronounce the words, and, you know, all of this. I lose the third page of my sermon, or whatever it is that I'm going to have to do. It's a much different thing, Tom.
I think one interesting question to ask might be, what is it that's counterculture about worship? Because, I mean, there's a big war out there about worship, and one of the issues is counterculture, and participation is counterculture these days. But also, I mean, much of the content is counterculture, and what worship is asking one to do in this culture is contrary to what the culture is asking you, hopefully. But, you know, in the face of that, there's all this market research out there that says, well, people like this, and people like this, and you will draw people if you do this, so that you can end up with something that draws a lot of people, but may may not be what worship is intended to be. And that's what the war is about right now. And I'm not advocating the war, but I want people to be aware that there is one.
Yeah. And what do you think worship is intended to be? It sounds to me like you've got something behind
it. I know.
That.
I mean,
countercultural.
It's hard to say in a sentence,
but you can have two.
I mean, the focus, whether the focus is on God and what God is doing in the world, or whether the focus is on making visitors feel comfortable or making us feel comfortable, I mean, that's one tension. But people disagree.
Well, you got two people to raise their hands by saying that. You haven't spoken, so I'd rather go through them. That's okay. Please, in the back.
Oh, one time when I was small, I thought, God must really have to hold his ears on Sunday at 11, because I thought worship then, and I still do think it is proclaiming God's word in whatever way we want to. I don't mean he really would hold his ears or anything, but just, can you imagine? Could he appreciate it all at once? I mean, I couldn't fathom that as a child. But what it is still that, I think, except it is us understanding the word of God in whatever way we can do that together. And we can do that so well with Tom and Mary leading us. And but we don't all have them at our churches. We can do it through the word and participating. We can do it in a combined way of all feeling and thinking a similar thought from our own what we're bringing to it. But I think to talk about what we're doing and what the word means, what is the etymology? Is it about worth? I think it is.
Work.
I think one of the countercultural things, in response, is the idea of submission. I think all good worship has an element of submission, because we've made a god of spontaneity somehow, or in a sense of whatever I'm thinking or feeling now is what needs to be expressed. And what I think, whenever you're in a community, as soon as somebody initiates, as soon as Mary starts a song, we are into submission to her direction and leadership for us to have good, unified, in a sense, worship together. Because for me to say, well, she wants to sing that, but I want to sing this, so I'll go sing my thing. And you can imagine what the church would be like on a Sunday morning, and or any time we gather for worship, if each of us decided how we're going to do this. But the spontaneity may come to one person, but as soon as the person initiates that, I must bend my will or submit my will to the will to the community. It's an act of compromise and submission, and for me, that's tremendously countercultural, in a sense that I willingly give up my right to tell God the way I want to tell God at that time, to submit myself to someone else's form and worship and leadership and style and key sometimes, you know. I have a low voice. I like these keys, but some people have high voices. And, you know what I mean? It all invites us to submit.
That is really helpful to me, and I think it's very Lutheran in a good way. I think Luther said we experience the grace of God through our neighbor, and using Mary as an example, we're charging her to be our leader, and I love that. I love it when Mary does it, but there are certain communities where my neighbor, I don't like what they're doing, and so that, I think that raises your question again, that sort of the content of some stuff that the content isn't maybe helpful.
Yeah, it goes beyond style. I mean, what's being said in worship, and you know, what is God's word? Let's talk more about that worship, and what does that mean for my life and for our lives and in this time, and not in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, but today in the 1990s. And you know, what's the alternative future that we're looking towards and God's leading us toward? I mean, that's what I want worship to be about. And,
Mary? We left your points. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Up here, yeah, good.
Something about this is causing me to think about this word that I like very much that I want to just offer here, but it's not a magic word or anything. one of the things that I do is write poetry, and so I think about words a lot, and I think about words with words. That's what I think with. And so I, a long time ago, as a writing teacher, quit saying, put it in your own words. It already is. But in talking about conversations, I often find it helpful to use the word interchange. I was very peevish about 10 years ago when people used the word interface. It came out of computers. And what interface means, if I understand computers, I think I understand this far, is that you know predictably exactly what's going to happen. Well, that's not a conversation. The interface, and you have this meeting, we're going to interface. And I don't care for exchange as a word for what can go on between two people having a conversation. I'm just using that metaphor now. But I like interchange. And when I apply that metaphor to worship, as it's all an interchange, it's an interchange between any individual and God, and any individual and any other individual, and any individual and any note of any piece of music. It's an interchange. Done.
Well, one of the things I forgot to say in my introduction is that, like many congregations' worship, Holden's forms go 60 minutes. And that's not because we come to the end, except of the time. I expect that the words can continue in this room, on the trail, at coffee break. This is sort of my ritual ending phrase I always use, that the conversation continues, but the form ends. So we thank you all for coming, and I hope that you do keep talking about this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, especially to you.